Good morning, Fox Valley. It's good to be with you again. It's been a while. It's fun to see your faces again. Our reading today comes from Reverend Victoria Safford. She is a UU minister in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, and it is called Hope. Our mission is to plant ourselves at the gates of hope, not the prudent gates of optimism, which are somewhat narrower, nor the stalwart boring gates of common sense, nor the strident gates of self-righteousness, which creak on shrill and angry hinges, nor the cheerful, flimsy garden gate of everything's gonna be all right, but a very different, sometimes very lonely place. The place of truth-telling about your own soul, first of all, and its condition. The place of resistance and defiance, the piece of ground from which you see the world both as it is, as it could be, as it might be, as it will be, the place from which you glimpse not only struggle, but joy in the struggle. And we stand there, beckoning and calling, telling people what we see, and asking people what they see.
I'm going to speak about hope, mystery, energy, creation. Hope has had increasing research study by psychologists, and while there have emerged components of hope, it remains a powerful mystery. Emily Dickinson's words about hope go deeply. Her vision of hope as a feathered singing energy that perches in the soul and keeps so many warm in the storm. Her words. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard that little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chilliest land and on the strangest sea. Yet never, even in extremity, it asked a crumb of me. The Benghazi poet Khalid Madawa has written about the struggles of refugees and hope as perhaps a turning point in suffering. I need not look deep into my past to seek a thousand hopeless vistas. But now that I have tasted hope, I have fallen into the embrace of my own rugged innocence. Now that we have tasted hope, this hard-earned crust, we would sooner die than seek any other taste to life, any other way of being human. So it seems that hope is redeeming, is strong and steadfast, even in the face of the greatest adversity, and is freely accessible. Our faith tradition does not codify what is the soul, but perhaps it is where so much energy, so many powerful stories, so much music, such powerful mythologies, and so many moments of compassion and intimacy coalesce to heal and to guide. Over 15 years ago, I invited Dr. Rick Snyder to speak at a psychology convention on his research about hope. I drove him from airport to hotel via the winding roads north of Madison and became, for longer than I would admit, hopelessly lost. But we talked deeply about children, grandchildren, illnesses, challenges, and our most compelling inspirations. Eventually, I recognized a crossroads, as I hoped I might. The next day, I even more deeply appreciated his work on how hope is a combination of way power and willpower, a la the old adage, where there's a will, there's a way. In his work, he found that hope combines one's will to shape one's future and one's ability to see ways to shape that future. In his words, if people see a way forward, they are more likely to develop the will to make it happen. I recall how nearly 50 years ago, my sense of hope was challenged. Suddenly married, child on the way, the convoluted maze of graduate studies, new town, low military draft lottery number, no car, two-room apartment, successfully sought my conscientious objector draft status, but then hoping to survive medic status in Vietnam in order to return to fatherhood. Uncertain how to care for a newborn, no knowledge of how to create a family that would succeed and survive the long run. Well, I did not have military induction due to President Truman's death and the end of the draft the next month. This reduced my fears. Family and school and community and careers emerged with shared effort of spouse Suzanne, our children, our pets, our outdoors. It feels now like hope is also a spiritual muscle, and that good old spiritual muscle memory is involved in dance as well as in all the rest of life. Hope can emerge freely, but requires nurturance to thrive. Thank you.
Beautiful, beautiful Betty had a terrible, terrible life. She gave me permission to tell her story to you. Her stunning good looks, which many of us would have been envious of, seemed only to work against her. Before she graduated from high school, she married a man who had money and power, but he treated her as his possession. He beat her, and he would even threaten to kill her. They had two children, and she knew she and her children were not safe with him. She begged her parents to let her move back home, but they didn't believe her stories about his violence. They told her to stay with this man. He was the father of her children. He financially provided her with a beautiful home and lovely clothes and a new car. These things mattered, they said. One particularly violent night, he held a gun to her head, and she knew in that moment she had to escape. After months of careful planning, she and her children did just that. It took a long time, but eventually her divorce was finalized. Her husband fought her every step of the way, but she was finally free of him. This would not be the first time that men would harm and threaten Betty. She was smart, but not educated. She had a sense of adventure, and she wasn't afraid to try new things. She became one of the first female tugboat captains in her small southern port town, and she loved that job. Well, one evening, the guys who worked on the tugboats invited her to join them for beers. The evening went well, but in the van ride home, one of the guys started to make lewd and suggestive comments to her. Suddenly, the others joined in. They attacked her that night, each taking a turn. Except for one, a friend, but he didn't stop the others. The next day at work, she didn't say a word for just having gone with them that night. She felt somehow she was to blame for that attack. 2 days later, she was fired. A friend said the other guys were afraid she'd talk. The men made up a bunch of lies about her that got her fired. When I met Betty, decades later, she was in her early 70s with cancer. The Betty I knew had a face that would light up whenever she saw you, and she delighted in the little things. She had a strong faith in Jesus, and every mention of his name brought a sparkle to her eyes. Betty had hope and assurance that she was going to a better place when she died. She was so unafraid of death. She welcomed it. Betty's hope in heaven, in a place of beauty that she fully believed existed, was palpable. And it got me to wondering, what is this thing called hope? We all experience it throughout our lives. We can actually feel hopefulness in our chests when it's strong and anticipatory. Hope can also wait quietly and influence us in our decisions as we face challenges or we look towards the future. And so I wondered, is hope useful? Is it helpful? Does hoping work? In this uncertain time, we have so little to lean on in terms of direction and guidance. The world is upside down with COVID-19. After the death of George Floyd, we are all looking more deeply and seriously at race issues and white privilege and our role in all of this. How do we find hope in this time of upheaval and despair? The definition of hope is a feeling of expectation and a desire for a certain thing to happen. Psychologist Neil Burton says that to hope for something is to desire a thing and then believe, rightly or wrongly, that the probability of it happening, though it may be less than one, is greater than it not happening at all. Burton says that when we hope, we don't actually know the odds, but with a combination of ignorance and defiance, we will often hope against hope. He goes on to say that when we hope for something, we're admitting that what we're hoping for lays outside of our control. This sounds a little bit like Las Vegas odds to me, but admit it. Hope is something we are all weighing right now as we're trying to figure out the risks of what we can do next and what might lay ahead in our futures. Hope is something that cannot be counted on, but if that's so, then why do we utilize it almost every day? In thinking about hope, I suspected that it had to be statistical in some way. My own experiences as a middle-class white woman has given me many opportunities throughout my life. I'm fully aware of this privilege. I know I have safety nets and resources surrounding me, not to mention good friends and family. So I wondered, is it easier for me to hope when I'm often rewarded with the things that I hoped for due to the resources and opportunities that I have? The odds are on my side, so to speak. Is hope something that we trust because of past experiences with its rewards? That made some sense to me, but if that's true, then what about beautiful, beautiful Betty and her horrible, horrible life? Even in her horrible life, she continued to cling to hope. While I was in seminary, I went on a social justice trip to Guatemala. During the 1970s and 80s, the government was systematically killing off men from the Mayan culture, the first people of Guatemala. Entire villages were wiped out and burned. Husbands and sons and fathers disappeared during the night, never to return again. This genocide went on for a long time. The women had to band together and find ways to survive in this violent and vicious regime. Years later, when I met them, they had indeed survived. Many had created cottage industries that supported them and their children in creative and meaningful ways. I was able to speak to these women through a translator. I asked one, what kept her going during that time when everything around her was on fire or being taken away from her? In a strong Catholic country like Guatemala, I was expecting her to cite her faith in God. She looked down for a moment, and then with a glint in her eye, she said instead, my children. I had to get up each day for my children. Her children gave her hope and purpose to get up and keep going. I heard these same words years later when a young father came onto hospice services with me. He was only 34, but he had pancreatic cancer. He was weak and his body had been decimated by chemo treatments. His doctor wanted to stop the treatments and put him on hospice. The plan was that he could rest and heal and probably get a little stronger, and then they could resume the treatments. This wasn't the first time that I've heard a doctor use hospice as respite, especially for a younger person. I had never seen it work, mind you, but cancer always won. But this idea, this hope that perhaps he could rest and get stronger appealed to this man. And as I would go to visit him and learn his story, I began to wonder if he was in denial. Did he really think that this hospice thing was just a stopgap as he got better? Experience is a funny teacher. I have since learned that sometimes denial is a very useful and hopeful tool. Because you see, that hope made him get up and spend time with his children in ways he never did before cancer claimed his name. He held on to that hope right up to the end. I recall sitting on his huge king-size bed 2 days before he died, and he smiled. "This is just a downturn. I'll be better next week," he said. Next week never came. But the gift of presence and love that he gave his children during those final months of hope was remarkable and precious. Hope lifts us up and moves us forward when we may feel we can't take another step. A slight breath of hope can fill our chest and give us strength to try again, even against all odds. I think this is the muscle memory that Mark spoke of. This hope, this feeling, has the capacity to give us such strength and such steel. I marvel at the human spirit, and I find this ability to hope to be holy and sacred. Hope is ethereal. It's untouchable. It's unseeable. And yet we physically cling to this thing. It's not even there. But yet it is, because we can feel the anticipation of hope in our very heart and mind and soul. My work in hospice helped me to see that hope is useful, and it gets us through dark times. Hope in healing, hope in heaven, hope in reconnection, hope in forgiveness. Hope gets us through difficult times, times when we may look back and wonder how we even survived, and yet somehow we did just that. As we're all experiencing COVID-19, we are clinging to hope right now. Hope that we can find a cure. Hope that we can keep ourselves and our loved ones safe. Hope that we can someday go back to normal, perhaps a new normal. Last fall, before COVID and the increased racial unrest, I was talking to one of my 90-year-old hospice patients, and I knew him to be liberal in his political beliefs, so I asked him what he thought about our current political environment. And he paused, and then he said, "This too shall pass." I had to sit with that for a bit. At first, it seemed so contrite, like what was going on didn't really matter. But then, after time, I saw it differently. We have been through even worse times in our nation's past, and we have come through those times as well. Our nation has been through the Spanish flu, world wars, polio, tuberculosis, McCarthyism, 9/11. And we came through it stronger and smarter. That gives me hope. But holding that, we must know that hope does not allow us to be complacent. It doesn't mean that we do not need to continue working with and respecting science. It doesn't mean that we lose sight of the need to fight for justice and equality for all people. In fact, within all the racial unrest and protests, I find hope that perhaps this time, we will really, really make changes towards equality for all people of color. Sherilyn Wagner, a 71-year-old Black woman from Austin, Texas, attended the March on Washington a couple weeks ago. She had taken vacation time from her job to be there for what she felt was an important event. She flew from Austin to Baltimore and then took a $70 taxi ride to ensure that she would be at the mall by 8 a.m. on that day. She had seen the fight for equality go through many changes, and she, too, is hopeful. I believe in this younger generation. Oh, yes, I do. I just know that the young people of today are going to take us where we need to go, she said. She has hope, and so do I. We've faced hard times before, and we were able to rise above it, and we found our way out even when it may have felt very dark for our nation. what's funny is humans, we're always learning. And then too, it seems we are always forgetting. But we seem to recall bits of what we've learned, and pieces of those lessons crumble into our pockets and we carry them forward. We do become better somehow, bit by bit, crumb by crumb. But the truth is that the opposite of hope is fear. Fear is the desire for something not to happen, combined with the anticipation of it actually happening. Inherent in every hope is a fear, and in every fear, a hope. Psychologist Dr. Judith Rich says that hope alone is not enough to affect any successful change. In fact, in a state of hopelessness, there is no light at the end of the tunnel. It's a dark and dense energy that can suck the life out of anyone who has ever experienced hopelessness. That hope is a match in that dark tunnel, a moment of light, just enough to reveal the path ahead and ultimately a way out. Hope is that bulb, that light, that lights up a room, revealing everything in it. And then the room may go black again, but hope gives us a glimpse of the possibility. Hope shows us the way, even if it's only for an instant. Hope is that spark that lights the fire of inspiration and imagination. Our children's video and the light bulb that was in our Wonder Box are simple examples of how we can bring hope through light. It is through our belief in that possibility that hope can create change in us. And that flash, that light that suddenly reveals what might be possible, I believe that that's us. That is our steely and strong human spirit. We are that light. And maybe that's why so often hope feels so close at hand. I believe the driver of that spirit is us, and a spirit of love that connects all of us. It's through our belief in that possibility and our intention to have it become a reality that hope can turn into change. Reverend Victoria Safford's words shared in the earlier reading reminds us that at the gates of hope, we stand together. There in the darkness, we're beckoning and calling to each other. We're telling people what we see, and we're asking people what they see. And that's how we find our way out. That's how we make change. I think we all want change right now. It feels like things are spinning out of control. And to be honest, it feels overwhelming. It feels like too much and it's too heavy. And some days I don't even know where to begin. But then I recall my 90-year-old patient's words of wisdom. This too shall pass. Holding that thought and holding on to a little bit of hope, perhaps we can get out of bed and put on our bathrobe, take a step forward, and even make a pot of coffee. Writer Margaret Renkel wrote a beautiful piece in the New York Times opinion page called One Tiny Beautiful Thing. First, she railed against the political scene, saying that paying attention to what's happening in Washington is so reality-altering that it should be regulated as a psychotropic drug. Add in coronavirus, and she says it feels like the apocalypse is here. But then a walk in the woods reminds her that it isn't. The woods were as lovely as they ever were. And the forest at the time was starting to show signs of life as it returned from its winter slumber. And in a rotted knothole, she saw a cluster of bright green seedlings bursting forth. She recognized it for what it truly was, life in death. In life, a resurrection. This brought her hope, but it also made her reflect on what she could do to bring hope back into her own life. At the time Renkel wrote the article, it was right before Easter, a time when many Christians consider things they might give up for Lent. Renkel decided to do the opposite of giving up something and instead decided to seek out as many ordinary miracles, as many resurrections as she could find in her daily life. I liked this desire to seek out ordinary miracles. They are all around us if we choose to see them. Albert Einstein said that we can look at everything as if it's a miracle, or that nothing is a miracle. I think the fact that you're here with us today, seeking comfort and peace, is an ordinary miracle. The fact that you have such a wonderful group of folks who put together these services in a time of crisis is a miracle. Frankl says that tiny, beautiful things are bursting forth in the darkest places, in the smallest nooks and crannies throughout our world. And in those dark places is hope. In those dark places, the light shines, maybe just for a minute, but it shines. She intends to seek them out. And I hope you do too, for we are that light. As cancer held beautiful, beautiful Betty a little tighter each day, she still found great joy in those little things as well. The big things were taken care of. Her kids were full-fledged adults and doing their best. She had a roof over her head, a warm bed in which to sleep, and a tiny Medicaid check that covered her needs. And she let everything else go, as she too learned that this too shall pass. And the horrors of her terrible life had slipped slowly from her grasp. She had even forgiven her rapists. "I had to," she told me. "I didn't want that event or them to have that kind of power over me." Oh, beautiful, beautiful Betty. What a wise and kind soul. Her days near the end of her life were filled with the joy of little things. A plant that blossomed, a call from a nephew, a Dairy Queen jelly bar. In these exhausting times, in times of darkness or feelings of helplessness, let us all find hope and reconnection to ourselves and to one another as we find hope and renewal in the little things. Let us keep our eyes open to life's tiny miracles. Let us be the light that flashes ever so quickly in the darkness. Let us hold each other's virtual hands and trust that we will find our way out. May it be so.